and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. A new report published by the Global Commission on Drug Policy has emphasized that the global goal of ending the HIV and hepatitis epidemics cannot be achieved unless there are significant reforms to current drug policies, which continue to criminalize and discriminate against the community of people who use drugs, which results in them not being able to access testing, treatment and care. Now, joining me on the show today is Professor Datuk Dr. Adibaka Marozaman, who is a member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy. She's also the immediate past president of the International AIDS Society and the current president and pro-vice chancellor at Monash University, Malaysia. Dr. Adiba, thank you so much for being on the show with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for hosting us in your office. I want to talk about this new report, which focuses on people who inject drugs. And I want to ask you why there should be an emphasis on this community of people who inject drugs in the fight to end the HIV and hepatitis epidemics.
Yeah, so thanks very much, Melissa. Through the years, we know that those who are high risk of HIV are those who belong to what we call key populations. And amongst them are people who use drugs, men who have sex with men, sex workers, and the reason being, and one of the factors that puts all of these people at high risk is because of the criminalization of these behaviors in many countries, which leads to those who are at high risk not coming forward for even education, much less efforts to give them effective prevention as well as treatment tools. And on top of that, the very act of sharing needles and syringes with blood that's been contaminated with HIV, you know, in terms of the volume of viruses that's around, puts people who use drugs and inject drugs in particular at extremely high risk of becoming infected with HIV. And we've known this since the very, very beginning of
But epidemic. After kind of 40 years of this fight against HIV and AIDS, there's been significant improvement in other segments, other populations of people living with HIV, but yet not so much in the community of people who inject drugs.
Correct. First of all, we also know what we need to do in order to reduce the risk of acquiring HIV amongst people who inject drugs. And we've known for many years that, I mean, we've known since the beginning of the epidemic that we need to provide them with clean needles and syringes. We need to provide them with treatment for their heroin addiction and now with other, you know, the trend of drug use has changed. However, the coverage of these very effective tools of provision of clean needles and syringes and what we call opioid agonist therapy globally is still very low. Fortunately, Malaysia saw the light in 2005 and instituted what collectively is called harm reduction, provision of clean needles and syringes and opioid agonist therapy. And we've seen a tremendous decrease in the number of new infections as a result of drug use. So that's number one, the whole prevention effort, which is evidence-based, being shown around the world, including in Malaysia, that works, but the coverage of it is not enough. And secondly, in terms of treatment, for people who use drugs who are already living with HIV, if you look, once again, in Malaysia and globally, if you look at who who's receiving antiretroviral therapy, by and large, the people who inject drugs are being left behind. Once again, for many reasons. One is, you know, unfortunately, even in this day and age, a lack of knowledge of the importance of this. Secondly, because of fear of getting arrested, they don't come forward. Thirdly, because they're in and out of prison, and even if they're on treatment, it gets interrupted, once again, as a result of criminalization. So there are many, many reasons why people who use and inject drugs are being left behind.
Can we explore those different reasons? I definitely want to come to the harm reduction strategy that I think you spearheaded back in 2005. But first, when we think about the behavioral patterns of people who inject drugs, how do they engage with healthcare systems? What do we know, particularly those who are living with HIV, what do we know about the way they engage with health systems, and how can we adapt intervention programs to fit those behaviors?
Yeah, so in the past, I mean, it still is the heavy stigmatization and discrimination against people who use drugs puts the fear in them in terms of coming forward to health systems, to health facilities for treatment, for even diagnosis. A lot of them, I'm talking in the context of Malaysia, a lot of them find out that they're living with HIV or hepatitis C in prisons and in pusat serentis.
They get diagnosed in
because
detention.
Because of the mandatory testing.
Oh, there's mandatory testing.
There's mandatory testing. And yet, there's no linkage to care. So many of them have been living with the virus for many years, and one is the fear of coming forward in case they're going to be ostracized, discriminated against, puts them, you know, at a reluctance to come forward to receive treatment. And secondly, you know, for this group of people who've been so marginalized and who know, you know, basically in and out of prison walls, there are other priorities in life than their own health.
Survival, right?
Survival, yeah. Getting a roof over their heads, getting a job, making sure they have something to eat, you know, and so all these things are priorities, and getting reconnected with their families and their own health becomes less important compared to you or
so
I.
So there seems to be this kind of risky environment of prison, right? Because they're in and out, they're in conflict with the law sometimes. Talk to me about, so there's mandatory testing to go into prison.
Once they're in prison, they will be tested
for
HIV,
and hepatitis. Yeah. Okay. What about the availability of healthcare or antiretroviral treatments in prisons? Is that readily available?
I would love to say yes, but unfortunately, it's patchy. And I've been working in Kajang Prison for more than a decade. And sadly, the whole prison health system comes in an almost no man's land. Ministry of Health seconds doctors to prison. For instance, in Kajang, I'm not quite sure exactly how many, but I think there are 3 medical officers there right now for a prison population of 6,000. No nurses, some MAs. I think there's 1 pharmacist there at the moment. So very, very rudimentary provision of health. And the budget comes from Ministry of Interior, Home Affairs. And so, you know, there's no kind of strong focus on the provision of health. And you can't sort of blame either of the ministries because there's no ownership. And I think, you know, when you talk about prison health, this is one area of reform that's very badly needed.
So can I ask you if there's also a high risk of contracting the virus while in prison?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Are we looking at prevention?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, very few prisons around, I mean, I can say that most prisons around the world you're still able to get drugs inside. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of denials by prison officials, but that's the truth, right? And what happens is people improvise and use equipment that's
not safe.
Not safe. having said that, very, very few prisons around the world, even in the most developed nations that are very liberal in terms of their harm reduction policies, provide clean needles and syringes.
Okay.
Second is, of course, sexual transmission. But more importantly, I think you pointed out, the provision of antiretroviral treatment. I think it's essential to provide, to ensure that there's no, well, first of all, to provide antiretroviral treatment and to provide and to ensure that there's no interruption in this treatment, because we know that treatment is prevention.
Mm.
Once you are on antiretroviral therapy and you're on it successfully, you bring the virus load to undetectable, the risk of transmitting to a sexual partner and perhaps even someone you're sharing needles with.
So treatment as prevention.
Is virtually zero. The evidence is mostly for sexual transmission. If it's undetectable, it's like zero transmission. So that's amazing. So the impetus to ensure that everyone who's living with HIV, no matter how you contracted the HIV, is very high. I mean, the evidence is very strong, and it should be something that we really focus on.
So I want to talk about that, this idea that, there's a struggle for resources, right? And looking to maybe funnel resources into prison healthcare, one way of doing that is maybe changing the way we funnel resources to law enforcement and the way we look at prohibition law policies.
Yeah. So what you're getting at it's better not to put them in prison in the first place.
Correct.
Because it's an expensive way of if you're just talking about dollars and cents, it's an expensive way of handling the whole problem of drug use. Firstly, just the everyday cost. Secondly, it's ineffective.
Mm.
How many people I encountered who've been in and out of prison no less than 10 times, which speaks to it being ineffective, right? And it's not a place for treatment of a medical condition that is addiction, right? They have no expertise, there's no, treatment available as in substitution treatment or opioid agonist therapy.
I think earlier this year we had the Minister in the Prime Minister's Office in charge of law reform, Azalina Osman. She talked a bit about how the government is looking to revise the present approach to drug dependency now to include medical intervention, maybe putting it in line with international communities. Mm-hmm. Approach of this being a medical condition. Is that something that
we completely applaud this move? And it's not just Dato' Sri Azalina, but Dato' Sri Saifuddin, Ministry as well, are working towards this. And as academics, as clinicians, as civil society, we completely are behind this. But what we would like to see is the shift, of course, is a huge paradigm shift, right? Mm. Mentally, yeah. and everything else.
For decades of this war on drugs mentality.
We completely understand that there might be, the public need to be on board as well and aware of what this means.
Mm-hmm.
And for us who are advocating for this, it means that not putting people who use drugs, who have not committed any other crime, but are in possession or are using it for personal use, that they be channeled to health rather than incarcerated.
What does that mean, channeled to health?
Channeled to health meaning, well, the model that's been touted for us to look at is the Portugal model. So where people who use drugs are assessed by a group of professionals, including people who are familiar with addiction,
okay.
Social workers and maybe people from law enforcement themselves. And if they are in possession of small amounts of drugs that would be more consistent with personal use rather than trafficking, that they are then, you know, offered counseling and so forth, rather than immediately being put into prison. Now, one other thing that we didn't talk about imprisonment, incarceration, is not only, you know, the cost to the government and the cost to society, but it leads to overcrowding, right? Which then leads to other problems such as tuberculosis, which is one of the reasons why I have this project in Kajang Prison. It leads to disruption in family life and a vicious cycle of young children without parents, etc. So there are many, many reasons. And of course, lastly, it's not an effective treatment for addiction, which we are trying to address. Hence, this Portuguese model is to channel them into healthcare and treatment, so they get the treatment and support and counselling for their drug use. Okay. And also, it's important to realise that not every drug user is an addict. There's a whole spectrum of drug use, right? People who use it recreationally, just at parties, versus those who've been using it and have addiction. So not everybody who has been caught using drugs is an addict that needs kind of serious treatment. Those who maybe, you know, if you're unfortunate and at a party and have just tried it for the first time and there's a raid and end up in prison, they probably need some kind of awareness.
Right.
Counseling and a fine.
So kind of first time offenders to not get the harsh, heavy hand of the law.
Because that then stops them from getting a job once they have a criminal record, prevents them from even going to university. And we've had many instances of this, right? So it destroys their lives basically forever.
The Portugal model that you were referencing, how might it work in a Malaysian setting? Are there nuances in Malaysia that it might not?
You know, I think.
Or would it apply?
Yeah, of course, it needs adaptation to local setting context, right? I mean, first of all, the important thing is for us to decide what is the threshold level that separates, you know, the possession, the amount that's in possession of someone that's for personal use versus trafficking.
What's that threshold?
What's that threshold? And it's, remember, it's for different drugs, from cannabis to cocaine. Right. I mean, cocaine's not very, very often used here.
Mm-hmm.
Cannabis, heroin, amphetamine, et cetera, et cetera. And so we, my colleagues and I, are hoping to launch a study to actually understand what is that threshold level for Malaysia. It's not going to be an easy study, and we're working with colleagues from Australia on this, because the purity of drugs at any given time changes, right? So we're hoping to launch this next year. We've already done some preliminary work around determining the threshold. As you know, I'm very for evidence-based
policies. That's fascinating to me, because
it's really important that we don't just adopt the Portugal model, we don't just adopt the Australian model, that it has to be contextualized to Malaysia and based on Malaysian evidence.
Well, yeah. It didn't even occur to me that you would need to determine, you know, that kind of threshold based on what is relevant for Malaysia.
Correct.
And you'd have to study that. And so it changes from country to country, and I'm sure from time to time.
Yes, because of this purity thing and just the trend. I mean, you know, years ago the trend was heroin. Now the trend is amphetamine type substances and polydrug use. So we need to completely understand
it's a lot more complicated and complex than
simply
saying, well,
we're going to decriminalize
drugs.
Exactly. So much as we want to see this happen, because there are too many people suffering, too many families suffering, we also want to make sure that this is done in an evidence-based manner. This is done well, this is done in a strategic and, you know, proper manner.
Are you seeing more acceptance to this thinking? You know, you talked a little bit about that mindset shift, right? We've been thinking a certain way for many decades, but are you seeing, you know, mindsets shift in that direction?
I'd like to think so. Okay. And I've been in this space myself for since in the introduction of harm reduction, where, well, you know, everyone thought the sky was going to fall.
Well, needles were, having the syringe program back then was, I'm sure, you had to convince a lot of people.
Correct. There was a lot of backlash well. But I think, you know, and this whole concept of looking at drug use as a health and public health problem, I do think has slowly grown acceptance. Of course, it's still going to have, groups of people who are going to be against it, including those in law enforcement themselves and even former people who formerly use drugs, because there's also this confusion over what is decriminalization. Is Prof Adiba and her group going to allow drugs to be available in every street corner, i.e. legalization, right?
Is that something you've heard before?
Oh yeah, all the time. You know, she's going to have a cannabis store in every street corner kind of thing. And that's not the intention at all. The intention, first and foremost, is to stop people who shouldn't go to prison for their drug use from going to prison, for all the reasons that we talked about earlier. Yes, in time to come, we do need to look at regulating drug use, just as we look at tobacco how hard it was to regulate tobacco and vape. Etc. But it's the same thing. These are substances that are harmful to people, but it doesn't mean that we should put them in prison, right? Alcohol, the prohibition of alcohol, decades ago, right, in the US, and it created the same thing. It created gangs, it created, you know, underground criminals. Once it was regulated, you know, it still causes the same harm to individuals as it does. But, you know, you remove that criminal elements to it. So I think that's sort of something that, down the line we need to think about. But for now, I think it's making sure that people don't go to prison just because they use drugs without all the other. Of course, if they steal, of course, if they hurt someone else in the act of, you know, finding money to use drugs, that's a different story. That's a criminal offense. Mm. But just being in possession of drugs and using drugs shouldn't be considered a criminal offense. But instead, what they need is help. Okay. What they need is...
Based on your kind of years of work in this space, what helps shift that mindset? What helps advance the conversation? What can the media and journalism do to help foster this public understanding about the need to support these critical reforms?
Exactly what we're doing here, I hope, you know, to have these conversations, to debunk some of the myths, you know, to provide accurate information. Because I think we in the medical and scientific profession have also done this whole drug use a disservice, because we've kind of let go and allow law enforcement to overtake the health management of people who use drugs. And and I think in the last few decades there's also much better understanding of what drug use is all about, from what puts someone at risk of using drugs, what are the biomedical and neurochemical changes that happens to the brain when someone uses drugs, the difference that different drugs does to the brain, and why, you know, the whole need to have, not that it's the only approach, but a biomedical approach, you know, the whole methadone and buprenorphine treatment for people who are addicted to heroin, for instance, and why cold turkey doesn't work, you know, because there are things that happens to the brain once someone is addicted. I mean, all that sort of basic understanding of what happens to the body when someone uses drugs have also improved. Mm-hmm. And so, and hence the need for a more biomedical rather than right. just lock them approach.
Yeah. So the more we know through science,
yeah.
the better policies
Correct.
Should be.
Correct. Right? Yeah. And the role of the media is to put forward mm-hmm. Those scientific knowledge and ideas and you know, to get people to think more rationally and not just kind of a knee-jerk, people who use drugs, mm. bad people, weak moral values, let's lock them up.
Well, that's hopefully the point of the show, is to reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate your time.
Pleasure.
That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching. Good night.